Before we get into today's podcast, I've got an invitation for you. We're about to kick off the sixth edition of our most popular program, The Neuroscience of Change. This training is based on what revolutionary research in neuroscience has revealed about transformational coaching, essentially showing us what works, what doesn't, and why. In the program, you'll learn what happens in the brain and body when different coaching techniques are used, how to guide your clients into positive learning states that allow genuine change to occur, and why some tried and true coaching methods actually inhibit change and what we can do instead. We created this course because I learned things from the lead teacher, Amanda Blake, that truly revolutionized the way I coach. And every year, she and all the teachers bring in new, cutting-edge science that continues to illuminate the process of transformation. Amanda will be joined by the rest of our world-class faculty of coaches and neuroscientists for this program, including Dan Siegel, Alan Fogel, Claire Dale, David Trelevin, and Richard Boyatzis. It's going to be an amazing, transformative journey. So I hope you'll come and join us. You can head to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. The first class is February 25th, 2025 with Amanda Blake. And if you sign up by February the 7th, you can get the early bird discount. So just go to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. Richard, it's really wonderful to be with you today. I really enjoyed our little preamble, our check-in. How are you doing?
Thanks, Joel. I'm feeling great. And as always, it's a delight to spend some time with you.
Yeah. I think we've got a lot to talk about today. Of course, your new book, The Science of Change, has come out, which is excellent. I recommend that to people. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I just want to name like the legacy you've had on the field of coaching. I think it's really important to name that. I see the influence that the intentional change theory has had on the field of coaching, the positive influence. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, we're going to get into what that is actually in our conversation today, but let me introduce you first to the people listening in the audience, and then I've got a question for you. So author and professor Richard Boyatzis is one of the world's leading experts in leadership development and emotional intelligence. He's been awarded the distinguished title of distinguished university professor at Case Western Reserve University. He's celebrated for his profound contributions across coaching, leadership, emotional intelligence. He's influencing both the academic and professional realms with his extensive research, and we'll get into some of that today. And he's a prolific author as well, or has authored several books, which I recommend. And the recent one we just named is out now, The Science of Change, which is all about intentional change theory, which is a multi-level fractal theory of sustained desired change at various levels from individuals to entire countries even. So, let me start, Richard, by asking you a question of what inspired you to write this book now?
I was getting to a point where I'm 78 now. I'm still full-time at Case Western, and I think when I turn 80, I might cut back a bit, but I'm still enjoying life. I still have a lot of curiosity. And the only complication is, you know, my wife thinks I need to spend more time not continuing to do more of this stuff. But it struck me that when I had this experience in the spring of 1967, when I was coming off of 5.5 months working as a research space rocket scientist for Northrop Norair. And I decided that even though I'd done everything in my life up to that point to do that, I didn't want to do it. It was boring. And I ended up taking some courses at MIT because I finished the degree in aeronautics and astronautics, but I took some courses in management thinking, well, that's what I'll do. And I signed up for one course because, I mean, the subject matter sounded like garbage to me. It was called organizational psychology, but I appreciate the fact that most of my life up to that point had been calculus and physics. And but during that introduction about the course, the professor, a young Dave Kolb, who created experiential learning theory that most people follow and know about, ended up saying two words that made me race to the basement to try to get into his class: no tests. So the reality is the entire course of my life changed because I'm test phobic and I didn't know it at the time. But what happened in that course is I discovered psychology, and I discovered something that was so meaningful to me that for the first time in my life, I understood that people could do something that was so powerful that they would do it even if they weren't paid. I didn't know anybody like that. Because all of my family members, my parents are immigrants from Greece, and everybody that I knew worked in restaurants in New York City, and they were good at it. They enjoyed it. But you know, when they could retire, they'd retire and go back to the old country or spend time with their family or do something like that. But work was always instrumental. Well, all of a sudden, I discovered work could be the purpose. And it was in that spring of 67, in a conversation with the young Dave Kolb, that I said I wanted to do my term paper on how managers didn't help their subordinates. I just spent five and a half months working in a research department, the experimental gas dynamics unit at Northrop Norair. There were two research departments that we had, and they were, everybody in them was either really smart or scary smart, but we were all universally weird. I'm sorry, there was one guy who was normal, but the two chairs of the departments were just like the rest of us. They were all extreme nerds. And I was overwhelmed as to how little they got out of us, out of this brain power that they had in their groups. And it was Dave Kolb who said, well, I've got some data on how our MBA, the version of the MBA students at MIT, were helping or not helping each other. We've been collecting this data now for a year, year and a half. Would you like to analyze real data? It's not manager subordinate, but it's helping. So I said, sure. And he liked what I did, offered me a summer job. And then because of that, we ended up publishing the paper. He got me into PhD seminars. So I'm in my senior year at MIT, and I'm taking two PhD seminars with Ed Schein, who became one of my mentors, on adult socialization. I'm taking two PhD seminars with Everett Hagen, who created the Psychoanalytic Historical Society with Eric Erickson. I'm taking courses with Carl Swanson and Jack Pugh, who are part of Jay Forrester's Systems Dynamics Group, and a course with Dave McClellan because he was on sabbatical from Harvard. And what I discovered was I love this stuff. And it was either the work on individual change, which is what the research that Dave and I were doing was focused on, or the work on community level change, which is what McClellan and some of the systems level change that the industrial dynamics folks were doing, that a number of those folks took me under their wing. And next thing I know, I'm in a PhD program at Harvard. So my path started in spring of 67 around the question of how do people change? And that's been my central curiosity for my entire life. That although the research that we started was on how do individuals change, and later, you know, by 1970, I was writing papers on organizational change, and by 72, I was working in community change. This quest is about how do people change in sustainable, desired ways. That's my life's purpose. That's it. And each one of my books, the research books, and then the last four practitioner books, not this one, but the prior ones, all came about because I felt there was enough research to be able to make a bunch of observations with integrity, with intellectual integrity, which is to say it's based on actual research, published peer-reviewed journal, all that kind of stuff, research. And that's what finally happened with this. I mean, I've been publishing various parts of it all over the place, you know, over all these decades, you know, from being a therapist and doing therapy with alcoholics and drug addicts in the 70s to helping to being one of the people that's one of the five people that's seen as starting the competency movement in human resources in the early 70s to coaching. I mean, I started coaching executives in leadership courses in 1969. And part of how I paid my way through my PhD program was by doing training leadership courses. And I had built into every leadership course that I designed a minimum of 1 hour, if not several 1 hour coaching sessions. And we actually called them coaching. So the idea that coaching came about in the 90s is absurd. I mean, I remember doing a workshop with Walt Mahler in 70 or 71 at Monsanto. And he was working, the senior VP of personnel, now we call it HR, had brought Walt in to try to teach their executives how to do coaching as a part of managing others. So it wasn't a separate role, but a process. And Walt was retired from Michigan, and he had already developed and validated a coaching practices survey under that name by 1970. So it's been around a long time. And the fact that my research kept coming back to not coaching per se, but the importance of the relationships, that it became so powerful. And that by the time we started to focus in 2000 on the physiological research, looking at hormonal systems and the fMRI studies, that's when we really nailed the fact that the mechanism of helping people sort through not just creating their vision, but actually sustaining any effort of change was always based on having these, what I call resonant relationships, relationships where you really felt in tune with other people. And even to the point where, you know, since 2007, when I developed a measure of it, so we now have over 55 different studies, many of which have been published, most of which have been published, saying that we actually can zero in on the qualities of these relationships. They have to do with shared vision, not goals, vision, purpose, shared compassion, caring, and shared energy. And that when those properties are present in the relationship, people are literally infecting each other with renewal and resilience. And that's the key to being able to sustain a change effort. So why do you need coaches? Well, you need them because if all you needed to do was to figure out what the problem was, people do that all the time. Hell, everybody is around you wants to tell you what your problem is. You know, from your bosses to your in-laws. So that's not the issue. And most people are smart enough. If you know that there is a problem, then you know what you should do to get there. But it doesn't happen. You know, so why do 80% of the people who try to pursue weight loss or becoming more physically fit and healthy or becoming more interpersonally sensitive? Why do people who want to pursue a better work-life balance? Why do people want to be more inspirational leader or coach? Why do only a small percentage of them actually change? It's, we start to discover that the mechanisms and the quality of the relationships. I mean, I have this phrase at the beginning of chapter 7 on these resonant relationships, in which I say relationships are the agar-agar in the petri dish of life. They're the context for everything. And if your relationships are ones that make you feel guilty or defensive, you're going to hunker down. Even if nobody's saying something to you, you're picking it up, because we now know there's direct brain-to-brain stimulation. And if what you're infecting other people with is a sense of hope and caring, then that's what happens. People open up. And even in something that we would think we understand coaching. It's amazing to me how many people who practice coaching still unintentionally or inadvertently act like a coaching bully, because the person experiencing it isn't feeling. They'll say, oh, thank you for the coaching, but they'll have their fingers in their ears because they just spent all this money or time. Of course, they're going to say rationalize that it was helpful. But you ask 6 months or a year or 2 years later, did that person change? And you find out, sadly, most people just revert. And a lot of it comes down to this issue of, in the interactions with the coach, did the person elevate their scope from specific problems or goals, which are inhibiting change, especially during the first 80% of a coaching relationship? And did they escalate the person's sense of renewal? In a sense, did they, I mean, any change effort uses emotional self-control. Emotional self-control stimulates stress. Stress closes you down. That's how it helps the body defend. So the problem is, every time you're trying to learn or change, you're using up what you might think of as all of this energy inside. Well, you have to periodically reinflate the energy. We now know from medical research that there are specific things that enable us to do that. I call them, for an easy word to remember, renewal. But they're technically activation of the parasympathetic nervous system. Now, I remember being involved in an effort with Herb Benson, who wrote the relaxation response that opened up a lot of meditation and things like that to normal people back in the 70s around stress management programs that nobody in industry wanted. Because as some of the top executives said, well, I want to increase the stress. I don't want to decrease it. Well, what I now know from these studies and from the medical part of it is that if you help somebody lower their stress level, all you've done is help them lower their impairment. They're still impaired. The only antidote to stress is these parasympathetic or renewal moments. So we published a series of studies on data that showed that the key wasn't having big blocks of time in renewal, like you take an hour and a half off at lunchtime to go work out or to meditate. It was having multiple 15 minutes, 10 or 15 minute episodes during a day. Because if you have one of these episodes where you go into renewal, you literally reset your body's flow of hormones. Re-energize, now you return to the effort. That's the movement. The movement. So in the book, I talk a lot about rhythm and dosage. And I think, one of the things you had mentioned earlier in one of our chats was about the ought selves. One of the things that happens to us very often is we are besieged with other people, well-intended, but nonetheless telling us how we should become, who we should become, what we should aspire to. And that's what I call the ought self. You ought to do this. You should do this. Now, again, setting aside the fact that it's well-intended and they may be right, how does it feel? Well, when you're told those things, of course, your first feeling is, well, I should be doing that, which is a statement, implicit statement of guilt.
Right. Let me jump in, because I think we're going to get into this topic more about positive Sure. emotional attractors and negative emotional attractors. But there's so much in what you just shared that I want to like come back to some moments of it. We're going to also talk about, the steps in ICT as well. But let me ask a couple of things first. Like, okay, so 15 minutes a day of renewal.
You asked me a question about why this book now. Let me clarify that although this book is what I'm thinking about as my magnum opus. I mean, it's putting together everything I've done for 58 years on change. But it's not just my work. I mean, I remember freaking out the editor when I handed in the manuscript on February 2nd because the references were 100 pages long. I mean, I've integrated into this the intentional change theory the work of several thousand scientists and their research studies. So it's a moment of capturing all of that, not just what have I been thinking about. Sorry to interrupt you, but.
That's what I really appreciate about your work is this bringing validity to what we can do in coaching. And so I've got some questions. Like, let me ask one first. You said like that, the resonant relationships, like that's something that coaches can really do. And the two questions I have around that is, you said before, like people can sometimes feel like they've experienced a coaching bully. And my question around that is how come? Let me just stop there and then let you answer that one first. I've got a question about AI as well. The question about AI is...
No. What's the question before that?
The one is how come some people leave coaching and they feel that, they might not say it explicitly, but even if it's implicit, they felt like there was a kind of bullying taking place. What's the coach doing there?
Now, I'm using the term bullying.
Yeah, I get it.
The client doesn't feel that.
No, yeah.
What the client feels is, oh, I should do that. I should eat more rabbit food. I should, more lettuce and things that are green and healthy and low calorie. I should exercise, every day or at least every other day. All of these things are shoulds. I should spend more time with my family. I should spend more time with my faith and prayer. I should. The person at that stage isn't feeling that you've been a bully. They just feel that you've helped them to see what they should do. The question is, what happens internally? And as soon as you experience should, or ought to, you're defensive because you're not there. And the implicit message from somebody else that you either respect or love or care for is, get your act together. And, stop being a slob, stop being not motivated, stop being, egocentric. And while those things may be true, the question is, do they help you motivate sustained desired change? And the answer is no. Why? Because they violate the sustaining aspect of it. That when you're doing it because you should, it's exhausting. And after a while, it's like, You want to be more fit. You want to lose weight. So you spend a whole day eating carefully, certain types of pure protein and a lot of, green salads. And you get home that night and I'm feeling righteous. And the second day you're doing it again, eating a lot of this rabbit food, feeling like you're cleansing your system, feeling righteous. The third day, somebody at work comes up to you and says something that absolutely pisses you off. And I mean, a major effect. And you go home and what do? Do you grab some lettuce? No, you grab a drink, eat some single malt scotch or some red wine, or, as I used to do, you grab Ben and Jerry's Chunky Monkey, or something like that. You go to something that will help you alleviate your anger or your frustration. And in that process, you've now stopped the change process. Now, does it mean you've stopped it forever? Maybe. But once you've stopped the change process, since it was such a pain, the next morning you get up and say, okay, I'll have an English muffin with my eggs. It's not going to kill me. Well, it's white. It's got a lot of other yeast and carbohydrates and other things that aren't great. But that's what happens, even in complex aspects of what we want to change. So it comes down to these internal processes, these hormonal and neural processes. Your body is going to help you defend itself to survive. Your body will always put the priority on you breathing compared to you learning something. So being open to a new idea or change is going to be less crucial than defending the organism. And that's where, as soon as you go into a defensive mode, now look, we have to, otherwise we don't survive. And there are a lot of moments in life when somebody is threatening you that you need to be in defensive mode. There are other times in which you need to be in this defensive mode to get something done, or to decide what you want to have for dinner. But if that's the way you're living your life, you're not replenishing this commitment to any of these changes. And that's the back and forth that people who actually do make sustained changes are able to do. And while we're talking about it as this positive emotional attractor versus negative, you could also see it in terms of, which is why I say very clearly, and our fMRI studies have shown, if in coaching you focus on specific goals, like focusing on specific problems, you're losing the client because you're actually stopping the durability of whatever it is that they want to work on. Now, coach goal setting is really useful, but way later in the coaching process, like 80% down the road. But at the beginning, it activates, when you have set a specific goal, it activates this need to prove that you can make it. There's 30 years of research showing. Once that happens, you're in a defensive mode. You're not open to new ideas. You're not open to other people. You're actually not even open to what the coach is saying at that point. So what does? Well, that's where our research has shown spending time talking about the bigger picture, the vision, the dream, your sense of purpose, what gives your life meaning. That turns out activates the parasympathetic nervous system, the renewal. So every time, I mean, I had this technique when I was still regularly coaching people other than my graduate students, of every time I would see them every 2 or 3 weeks, I would start by saying, you know, give me an update on your vision. Even though I knew chances are their vision hadn't changed since the last time, and I remembered it, I wasn't doing it for that reason, although that might have happened. I was doing it more because I wanted to open the session with them talking about why they're alive, what their purpose is, because that puts them into a place where they're more open.
Yeah, that's important. That was going to be a question I had. So what I'm hearing is, yeah, actually don't start with goals, because that can tend to kind of focus on what's not right, the problem, and narrow down the vision. And we'll talk about the positive emotional and negative emotional attractors in a moment, what they are. But you start with the vision, which is kind of opening somebody, priming someone to this state of change, right, the possibility of change. And then I'm hearing that as you move through that process, you as a coach and as the coachee, you want to kind of learn how to kind of tap back into that,
right,
that state that's conducive to change, because yeah, it's naturally going to kind of get used up. You know, they'll naturally, yeah, close down. Yeah.
So let me tie that back, Joel, to the question you just asked that I veered from. Sorry. The problem of talking about your life's work, it's, what happens when, you know, you see your internist who says, you know, you really have to lose another 20 pounds. And the only way you're going to do that is to exercise more and to eat less. So you walk away because you want to be healthy. And you say, look, I should lose 20 pounds. I should exercise more. I should eat less. Now, again, the next day, you may pursue that. But what happens 2 weeks later? What happens when a storm comes and you don't have time to exercise or you end up eating whatever you can quickly cook because the, you know, the heat's going to go. What happens when two of your children are having sports events and you have to go attend those and you can't take the time out to work out? What happens when you've got a report that you've got to write for a client? So the dilemma is not that those things aren't important. It's that, are you experiencing them as things that you really want to do? So if your vision is to be a loving parent and family member and to really help other people inspire change, you know, which is a vision that a lot of coaches I know share. But if that's your vision, now all of a sudden you're saying, well, wait a minute, that's true, but what I've got to work on today is losing weight and eating less. While you can register the fact that it's important, again, how does it feel? It feels like, damn, you know, I got to work on this. So at that moment, the person who told you you should do that in your head becomes a helping bully. You don't see them as a bully, but because they're reminding you of something you should do, that's not what you want to be spending your time on, you end up going through this tug of war inside. And I'm telling you that what loses out are the shoulds, because it just is too exhausting.
And so there's an element of compliance.
Yes.
That. And that's yes. Like I've seen that. I've experienced that even when, you know, 360 assessments or psychological assessments. And even though they really make an effort to be kind of compassionate, just that act of being kind of fit into certain categories from the outside, I remember like it can create that kind of physiological feeling of defensiveness. You know, even though I consider myself a quite spacious and open person, you know, even like feeling a little bit hurt in a way. So like what I'm hearing is that actually it's much better to start with the client and say, okay, what's your vision for yourself?
Right.
Tell me all about that. Let's expand that and color it in as much detail as you can.
So the way I say, if somebody has a presenting problem, I ask them what that is, because otherwise, you know, that'd be silly. It wouldn't be nice, discourteous. But I never spend more than a few minutes on it because I don't want them to wallow in it. I say, you know, we're going to work on that. But first, I want to understand you. Give me the big picture of you. And that's where I'll introduce, what's your purpose? I'll introduce vision. But I fully well know, because I teach this in all my graduate seminars with the executive doctorates, the 50-year-olds, and the 40-year-old EMBAs, many of which are surgeons, and the 40-year-old OD and coaching students. I have them go out and practice this coaching with compassion. And they often will talk to somebody and be talking to people who have trouble thinking about the answer to the question, if your life were fantastic 10 to 15 years from now, what would it be like? There are people who have trouble thinking about that. So my recommendation to them is, okay, there are a lot of people who are stressed and who are feeling oppressed of one way or another or burdened. So you may have to introduce, you may have to get them into a little bit of PEA before they can be open to thinking about what they want to dream. So I say, okay, go to the playful question. You just won $80 million after tax in the lottery. How does your life or work change? And sometimes a person can get playful about that and it starts to open. Well, I'd like to open an animal shelter. My wife and I have talked about opening a home for battered women that has a different model and something like that. And then you can come back to the dream question. So I'm not suggesting that getting people to talk about vision is easy. And the more successful they are, as I said, the more odd cells, the harder it is to get there. But that's the context. That's the thing that gets people energized. And that's what keeps them revitalized.
Yeah, beautiful. And so we'll talk about the relationship between the ideal self and the ought self in a moment. But I want to come back to this idea of renewal. You've spoken about how, so someone's got this vision and then you're working with a coach and you're moving forward. And you talked about it's really important to kind of access this renewal state. And I'm wondering about how we can do that and the relationship between that and the ideal self and a coaching trajectory. Like if you could.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, well, so thank you for handing me the softball question, but because it's a key feature of many of the presenters in your Coaches Rising certificates programs, because Amanda Blake does it by starting each coaching session with deep breathing. That actually puts you in the parasympathetic nervous system. I like to start it by asking people about their dream. People have different techniques, but the idea is even when you're sitting down with somebody that you've had an ongoing relationship with, you don't want to open with how's it going, because 80% of the time people are going to say how much life sucks right now, or this is bothering them, because that's what comes to the surface. So what you want to do is play into these core emotions of hope, compassion, serenity in terms of mindfulness or energy. And that's where a variety of techniques. Now, you can use it when you open your coaching session, but you're also, that's why it's important that the coaches feel renewed and periodically make sure that they're feeling sustainable in their efforts, because they're going to exude that in terms of these brain-to-brain communications to their client. So the question ends up being, what do you do during, if you have an hour and a half session in the coaching, how do you periodically introduce PEA moments, moments of renewal? And that's where sometimes it's the kind of question you ask. So I find to never ask a why question, because it always asks people to defend themselves. Give me the rationale. And, sometimes there are other questions that have an implied criticism or judgment. You're wearing that today? That's not exactly an opening question. And then teaching people to be patient and to wait for the person to offer. That's something which I wrestled with when I was in training to be a therapist. And a lot of therapists have learned that painfully. It's harder now that we can't smoke, because I used to use cigarettes as a way, or pipes as a way, to keep my mouth busy so that I wouldn't keep intervening or asking questions. So some of it's waiting. Some of it's asking a simple question. Tell me more. Can you give me more details? So, and sometimes it's, again, using this notion, which you and I have mentioned, but this thing about rhythm and dosage is really important. It's important in each coaching session, but it's important in the coaching relationship as well over time. So having some questions that could really help the person move back into a PEA, as they wrestle with the tensions or the challenges that they face. I don't know if I'm being clear, but that's what I think a coach practically can do, to have a repertoire of these things that they could do in the coaching session within an hour and a half, but also knowing that they're thinking about them. So one of the things I used to like to do was to give people action learning assignments in between coaching sessions. And often the action learning assignments weren't to do something, it was to try something, big difference, or to talk to someone and find out what's things. One of the most powerful exercises, I had colleagues and I in the late 70s, early 80s at McBurr, my former research company, were doing, was called Me at My Best, which I learned later folks at University of Michigan were doing as the best self exercise. But in Me at My Best, I would rather, if somebody's going to learn about their strengths, have them do it by talking to people. Because the interpersonal act seems to be really important around that. So even today, I use this exercise where I'll say to somebody, I want you to identify 15 to 25 people that you interact with at home, at work, or in social settings on a regular basis. And I want you to ask them for 20 minutes. And if you can, record it, because you'll forget pieces. And ask them one question twice. Can you tell me about a time in which I was at my best? And you get them to tell you the story. Well, what was I saying or doing? You know, 10 minutes. Can you tell me another time in which you thought I was at my best? So you get that. Stop there. Don't go on to anything else. Don't say, what could I do better or anything like that. Just stop there. Thank them. Then you pull this away. So now let's say you have 20 people. You've got 40 stories of when you were at your best. Look at them. Look at the themes and patterns. If something, if a way of acting or feeling or being on your part is present in one third or more of those stories, that's a strength. You're doing something now that other people think and experience you as at your best. That's a strength. It's a mistake to say, well, let me talk about my weaknesses, which they didn't mention, because we don't know that they didn't mention it because it's a weakness or they just forgot. But what we do know is what they did mention would be considered a strength if it's a pattern. And I find that to be much more helpful than taking a test, for example.
Yeah, I like that too. Like the kind of feedback, I don't know if I like that word feedback, it's very problematic, but the times where I've received the most useful sense of who I am has been through live conversation and attributed feedback. And it's been, that's right. Been very rich. It's because then you know, it's not this kind of like unknown feedback.
We found in our, we were, Tony, Jack and I were pushing this issue because we suspected that it was the interpersonal interaction that really made a difference in coaching. So we had set up the second, actually it was the third in the series of fMRI studies, but the second one specifically on coaching to test something about dosage. And we had people having a 30-minute conversation about the challenges they're facing right now. NEA. Not that it's negative, but it's guilt-inducing. And then the positive, PEA, was the vision. And then we had some people have two of those and some people have three of those. These were 30-minute conversations on different days. Then they, 3 to 5 days later, they went to an fMRI machine. What we found was that if they had two or three PEA sessions, excuse me, to the one NEA, they activated the ventral medial prefrontal cortex. It's the thing back here. And Naomi Eisenberger has shown for years that this is one of the key parts of the brain, the default mode network, that activates the parasympathetic nervous system, the renewal hormonal system. But in the last 10 years, a number of researchers have published studies showing that this is a part of the default mode network that is key to interpersonal interaction and to empathy. We found that two or three PEA sessions activated that a lot, significantly. One didn't. Spending an hour writing your vision didn't. But the conversations did. So the self-reflection, even for introverts, is not enough. There's something in the interpersonal aspect of it that ends up being powerful, which of course, if we go into artificial intelligence, starts to raise questions about what degree of efficacy do the bots have?
Yeah, I mean, let me ask you that, because that was a question I had.
Right.
What do you think about AI in that in terms of resonant relationship
The
and
part of artificial intelligence that I think can work, Nikki Terblanche at Stellenbosch has done marvelous writing about this and studies, because he developed a few bots years ago, coaching bots. But I think coaching bots can supplement coaching conversations because they can help you, in a sense, like an app, remind you of something. But do they replace a coaching conversation? No. And I think that's because there's something that happens in the emotional exchange. It's not just ideas, it's feelings. And I mean, I know in one paper, Tony, I'm not Tony, Nikki showed that humans seem to be better in the early part, like pulling on vision and purpose. But in the latter part, where you're talking about working on a goal, the bot was just as effective or slightly more effective. So I think that starts to tell us where some of the issues are. On the other hand, as Nikki has been, Terblanche has said, it could be a democratizing force. It could bring the benefit of being coached to millions of people who otherwise can't afford a one-on-one coach. So there are a lot of good things about it, but I also want to put it in the context of I just finished an article I submitted to a journal about how I think peer coaching in groups can be a major democratizing force, because peer coaching in groups provides some benefits, or can provide benefits, that even one-on-one coaching doesn't. The big one, which is the argument I was making, is it can be for the 78% of the people with jobs in the world. Those people work in small organizations, small businesses or government agencies or NGOs, and they don't have any budgets for one-on-one coaching. So peer coaching could, if introduced right, could really help them. Peer coaching in groups, I think, has a similar set of benefits as some of the artificial intelligence bots would.
Yeah, that's interesting that you say that, because that's been part of our exploration. We had Nikki on the podcast, and the relational piece is key for me, the human to
Right.
human. Like, it's not
Right.
just about efficiency and performance around goals and data. There's this whole kind of social, emotional, physiological piece of being in connection with another person, which so far I don't know if AI will be able to evoke.
I mean, it may at some point, but
It
people have
may,
been
yeah.
talking. I mean, I worked on a computer program called Doc in 1968 at MIT. And it was MIT's first attempt to explore remote computer processing, which meant we had access to a teletype machine, one of these really, it was like 3.5 feet high. And, unlike a regular typewriter, you really had to push the button down. Well, they had two 360s, IBM 360s, at the computer center, which was about half a mile away. And they allowed us unlimited time from 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. because they just wanted to encourage people to use it. And so we were doing some serious research on creating a computer program to predict who would and how would people change their behavior. But every so often we'd get tired and we'd want to play around. And one of the other doctoral students and I, he had come up, he had found this program called Doc. And you punched in hello. And the doctor said, okay, I'm the doctor. How can I help you today? And you're supposed to punch in your problem. And it went back and forth. This is 1968. So bots have gotten a lot more sophisticated. But let me tell you, when you actually look at to what extent are they really different than what that? Not that much compared to the fact that that was 50, years ago, almost 50 years ago, or 55 years ago. Yeah. So the interesting question is, yes, you have avatars asking the question. You've got female voices or male voices. You've got this or that. There are all sorts of enhancements, But fundamentally, artificial intelligence has not gotten to the point where they can pick up on your emotional cues. Now, at some point they may. At some point, the facial recognition might signal that, uh-oh, there's pupil dilation occurring, stress is, let me say something that will calm the person down.
Yeah.
I also wonder, we're not about, there yet.
Yeah. You know, how easy it would be to kind of turn off a session, you know, if I'm with another human being, I'm not just going to end the call. Well, people might do, but if I'm with an AI coach and I'm, you know, I'm like, you know what? I'm off. See you later. Just switch it off. There's a small point, really. But I want to ask you about the...
Well, think about that with apps.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a lot of healthy apps that help you think about things. Exactly. I mean, this one group in the UK developed, well, we developed for them, but they gave us the structure of an app based on our 2019 book, Helping People Change. And I was very excited with having it be a supplement to the coaching. But and for the few people who have tried it, it's very positive feedback. But I'm frustrated by the fact that most people don't want to go that far.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. There's something about the social,
right.
Impulse, the social kind of proof, the social contact that feels so important. And let me ask you about, I want to ask you about PEAs and NEAs, because we've talked about them a lot without
right.
saying what they are. And I think they're central to this whole conversation. Could you describe
right.
what they are and
the positives?
Yeah.
The positive and negative emotional attractor are two psychophysiological states inside of each one of us as individuals, but inside of each team or family, inside of each organization, inside of each community. The positive emotional attractor is being in the parasympathetic or renewal hormonal state versus the negative being in the stress state. It's activating the default mode network in, you know, neurologically, whereas in the negative emotional attractor, it's activating the task positive network. It's using positive adjectives versus in the negative emotional attractor, negative adjectives. These two states are crucial because you're drawn to one or the other. There's no such thing as resisting change. You're drawn to a positive attractor or you're drawn to a negative attractor. And I call them strange attractors because I think you're drawn to revolve around them like a planet around the sun. It's not like there's another kind of attractor called the limit point cycle where you're drawn into it like a black hole, but you're drawn around it. And the difference is the moment you're in that one that allows you to be open to new possibilities and ideas and people, feeling excited, feeling renewed, or is it a state in which you're focused, intent, and defensive? Now, what I kind of articulated, and this was about in the year 2000, I was teaching a graduate course in our School of Engineering with a mathematician, a member of the Club of Rome, the systems, very senior faculty, and a geneticist on complexity theory in this graduate course. And it dawned on me that I made a mistake, that I hadn't specified how to help somebody move the next phase of a change process to keep it sustainable. And that's when I went back and started to articulate this positive versus negative emotional attractors. So they're the thing that tips you into the openness to be able to go to the next stage of change or tips you into holding you back. So the NEA is regressive, the PEA is progressive. And now inherently, because these two states have a different degree of openness to other people and ideas, even when you're in one phase of the change process, even when you're trying to explore and create your sense of personal vision and purpose, articulate it, it helps to go into the PEA, because then you're more open. But once, you know, it's like once I knew that I had to write a section of one of my chapters on a particular topic, I had to go into the NEA to get that damn thing written, you know, and it wasn't, but I would periodically remind myself of why, you know, where it fit in with the big picture, why I was excited by it, because that's what kept me going. Otherwise, it would never have gotten written. So these two states end up being tipping points, but the big difference is one helps with sustainability and the other reduces the sustainability. Both are necessary. You can't do any change without going back and forth.
So if we had an example, like say someone who wanted to, you know, a leader who wanted to develop their capacity to both be, you know, inspiring and full of presence and connected with another person, then you know, it would be important that they would clarify that vision, the compelling vision that they felt drawn to. And
well, let me say I don't think the challenge would be those two parts that you said. It would be between either of those and getting something done. So if you had the executive who wanted to get an innovation introduced, but they also wanted to be inspiring and connect with the key individuals that they're working with, how would they go about doing it? Well, first of all, every time they would start a meeting, they would open with something that was PEA. So you either open with a statement about the purpose, or you told a story about a client who was helped, or you got people to talk a little bit about the values, what's driving them, why are they doing what they're doing. 5 minutes. You don't need a lot of time, maybe 6 minutes. But what you're doing is getting people into that mood. And then you could say, okay, now to get there, I think we have to implement this innovation. So now you're switching into the NEA. You're trying to get people to focus and to do the analytic work. And then after a certain amount of conversation, you want to bring up another PEA moment. Now, really effective leaders do it through telling a story or through humor.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the idea that you, while you're in pursuit of the technical challenge, you periodically introduce something that makes people return to this kind of open state. Then they use up the energy, then they...
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a really helpful example, actually. And I'm thinking on an individual level as well, because I know you said that leader might be struggling between being inspiring and relational and focusing on getting stuff done or innovating. But it could be that they're also wanting to be inspiring and relational, but there are parts of them that feel, you know, that they're not allowed to be fully in the space, you know, like they're not enough to be there. Like I've encountered that a lot with people I coach. Like it's like there's a kind of
explain
sense
it. I'm not following.
Yeah, so it's like sometimes for people, embodied inside of them is like younger parts that grew up around, you know, difficult childhood experiences, and those parts show up when someone comes into a space and they need to lead, you know, but they can feel inside a kind of physiological, emotional reaction to being with those people, like a shrinking back or a timidity, or, you know, like their voice might sink inside of them. And I'm curious how, you know, the intentional change theory would play
sure.
out here.
Well, some of it ends up being a technique that the therapy program I developed based on research that McClellan was doing and I joined him on was an early version of what later became cognitive behavior therapy, because we wanted people to be aware of when they started to feel powerless and instead of drinking or taking drugs, to do something else that would make them feel powerful, you know, whether it was meditating or prayer or exercise or having a loving conversation with somebody. So part of the techniques that you actually can teach a person is how to be aware when something in the situation or a person triggers the NEA. Now, if you're aware of that and you're running a meeting and this person walks in and they're a person who's a real pain in the ass, and they usually find very subtle but effective ways to derail your conversation, if you focus on that, you're going down the quagmire, the quicksand of negativity. You're not going to handle it well. You're going to rise to their bait, and it's going to be ineffective. So assuming you didn't anticipate it, so you tried to say something to them before the meeting to take the edge off, if you're in the meeting and that happens, you've got to immediately be able to say, uh-oh, you know, I'm starting to get riled. I need to change that. Why am I having this meeting? And like, who the hell cares that so-and-so is in this room? You know, they're just one person out of the 12. Why am I having this meeting? It's because I want people to be excited about this innovation, or I want people to be excited about this new program. So one of it is you just quickly remind yourself why you're there and that it's bigger picture. See, this is always the thing. Don't let yourself be drawn into the narrow. Step back.
Yeah.
You can do it personally. I mean, I can remember this one moment. I was department chair for about 8 years, and we had a reunion of a lot of doctoral students. And in the first day, a whole bunch of these doctoral students who graduated in the 60s and 70s and 80s were there, because this was all happening in the late 90s. We're sitting around in this group thing, and they're, you know, they're all old white guys, mostly with, you know, hair and ponytails, and talking about how the department had sold out. We'd catered to the military industrial complex, and, you know, we were getting funded research, and we were, you know, giving in to the man when our purpose was social change. And, you know, I listened to it. I was department chair, so I was ostensibly responsible for the second and third day of this. So I'm, you know, it ruined my sleep that night. I went home. I lived close enough to the retreat center. I could just drive home. So I'm driving to the retreat center that morning. It's about a 30-minute drive. And I realized that my hands were so tight on the steering wheel that my knuckles were turning white because I was angry. I mean, I really wanted to throw up on these people. And I said, this is crazy. You know that if you walk into the meeting this way, you're probably going to do that and just not get anywhere. So I said, you know what? I started thinking about my wife and our two dogs, our two golden retrievers at the time. And I thought about a walk we took last week in the woods and how much fun it was. And then I thought about another moment that we had just on a Sunday morning, walking with the dogs up to the local Starbucks, and a funny thing that happened with one of the dogs who got off the leash. We're running around looking for her around these several blocks, and she just went back to the Starbucks and was sitting out in front waiting for us. You know, so it was like, I think about several of these moments, and that's what it did to me. It made me smile. It made me laugh. And I eased up on the hands and the steering wheel. And in that moment, it dawned on me how I should approach this. Not to berate them or to defend against it, but just to show them. So that morning, we had two round tables. First, it was a collection of our doctoral students, current doctoral students, sitting in a fishbowl. Everybody else was watching, talking about what they're learning and what kind of projects they're working on. Then, and we talked about that as a whole, then we had another one of the faculty, the current faculty, sitting talking about what projects they're working on, et cetera. So when both of these things were done and we processed them a bit, I got up and I said, while people were still sitting in different ways around it, I said, for all of you, you know, who were around in the past and who felt that we were not working on social change and not fulfilling our real purpose, I said, I want you to look and listen to what you just experienced. Look at these two groups. You see, we aren't going out and protesting for diversity. We are diverse because, you know, every one of the groups had people of varying colors, varying genders, varying faiths, varying ethnicities, varying sexual orientation. All of that was present among the current doctoral students and among the current faculty, and it was visibly evident. And then when they talked about the projects they're working on, they were projects that were helping people and organizations and communities change. So all I said was, you know, you berated, you know, you criticized us for drifting from the rhetoric of championing change. Well, I think we've actually gone beyond that because I think we are the change. And I think we're currently pursuing it. And it was like, boom, boom.
Yeah.
And I never would have gotten there if I hadn't stopped during that drive worrying about it and flipped to thinking about my wife and the dogs.
What I think you're articulating really beautifully is something that's so important, which is state mastery. And, you know, our tendency to kind of orient towards problem solving, a problem solving mindset, you know, and it's insidious, you know, it's even in the community I'm in of like people who are deeply dedicated to practice, we're continually humbled by that tendency within us to kind of shrink and start to see everything as a problem, start to blame others.
Yep.
And it has a particular valence to it. And, and we're also very familiar of what it's like when we can bring a level of inclusion and acceptance to what we're experiencing and then begin to connect to a sense of potence, of possibility, which is very potent. And I hear that that's a very powerful act of leadership that you did there. You pointed out what was happening and how that was in line with the vision and created a sense of possibility that wasn't there before. And that's something that I think as a species we're being, you know, we're being invited into how we can do that on a collective and individual level.
And I mean, I hadn't thought about it in terms of my theory because I hadn't articulated the PANEA because I think this happened around 1998, as much as I did by 2000 and 2001. But the fact is that these old alums were talking about the fact that we weren't protesting enough. We weren't railing against the power system to get these changes. My point was, we are the changes. Look at the group. We've already changed. We're already living the change, and we're pursuing the change across a broad spectrum. We may not be as loud and as noisy and as confrontational about it, but I actually think we're getting there.
Yeah.
That's NEA versus PEA.
We're at time, more or less. I just wondered if there was anything you want to say to the coaches listening as an invitation. I want to ask where we can find out more about the book and your work in a moment, but is there an invitation or anything you'd like to say as a closing remark?
Any of us that are trying to help others in roles as coaches, we want to help people. That's why we're doing it. And what becomes clear when you study the mechanism is we actually have to first and foremost pay attention to ourselves. We have to feel inspired about our vision. We have to feel like we're living our dream. Otherwise, we're not infecting people with this degree of hope. And then what I think we have to do is be curious. And I think that the more we can be curious, the more we can pose the questions instead of immediately going to the answer. I mean, in my new book, I devoted the whole last chapter to the research questions that need to be asked and answered to move our understanding of sustained desired change to the next level. All because I want more people. I want graduate students to take these ideas and create studies and theses. I want faculty to do that and guide them. I want professional coaches to team up with other people and do some studies that will pursue more answers to some of these questions.
Could you name one or two of those questions as well? Sorry, I cut you off. Yeah.
Well, one was, for example, I mentioned the peer coaching in groups. I mean, this phenomenon has been around for thousands of years, and certainly Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, really made it a common practice. But we don't, I mean, we have one study. There are a number of studies that are just appearing of one-on-one peer coaching, but peer coaching in groups, there aren't. I mean, one study was the thesis, PhD thesis that one of my former doctoral students just finished, Roman Turekin, that he's in the process of submitting various articles. Another one, Maria Volkova-Fedek, just finished, and she's pursuing another study. Another one, Mai Trinh, S.R. Aurora, is doing at the University of Texas. So I think we need to have people who appreciate peer coaching in groups start to team up with folks to collect data. We need to know, how often should they meet? How much training do they need? Do they have to have a facilitator or not? Those are the kinds of things that are the practical questions. Well, the theoretical questions are, how do you help a group of people that come together become not just a support group to the task group, but a social identity where their relationships all of a sudden get really deep? And there are certain other theoretical things, but that's an example of several research questions around just one aspect of it. In chapter 9, I talk about half a dozen research questions for ideal self, for the real self, you know, looking at the ought self and faux self, looking at learning plans, looking at resonant relationships, looking at social identity groups, looking at some of the multi-level aspects of it. So the curiosity, if I can imbue people with something, I wish I had something I could give people a shot of, you know, the Ozempic for curiosity, that all of a sudden would make people want to not just think about it, but also team up with some folks and do some thinking, writing, research about it.
Yeah, beautiful. Richard, where can we find out more about your book? And I want to recommend people go and check out The Science of Change, of course. But yeah,
of course, you know, the largest bookstore in the world, Amazon, has it. And you can order it in almost every country of the world, because Amazon now has it open in various European and Asian countries. Other language versions are on the way. I mean, at least 5 languages have already been signed. I'm looking forward to more. But meanwhile, if somebody did read the book and liked it, there's always, you know, if they sign on to my LinkedIn, I post various podcasts that I'm doing. And also, when I come across a book or an article that I think is really engaging, that I'd like to recommend there, I and my colleagues have now started paying extra to the academic journals, the amount we have to make sure that the articles are what's called open access, so that anybody could, you know, click on the PDF and get a copy, rather than what used to be or still happens is, if you don't have a subscription, you can't get it. So the articles, if you want to read the technical things, are there. You know, we have a master's program at Case in leadership and organizational change that features this approach to coaching. We also have certificate programs through our executive education activities. So these are all different ways that people can get access to it. But it all starts with the book, makes great Thanksgiving presents, or if you're prepared for the holidays, Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa.
Yeah, beautiful. Thank you, Richard. Yeah, for sharing yourself so generously, and for the legacy of your work. You know, like, I just really want to bow to you for that, because it's, yeah, you know, like, it's helping us all think more deeply about the science of change, and also influencing the field. Like, I see that in positive ways, you know, like, yeah, very positive ways. So thank you.
Thank you for a PEA hour and a half.
Yeah, cool.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. And a reminder that the early bird enrollment is now open for our upcoming live training, The Neuroscience of Change. This program reveals the biology of change, showing us what happens in the brain and the body when different coaching techniques are used. You'll learn how to work with the innate pathways of change in all of us, so you can create powerful transformation with your clients. Just go to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. And remember, you can get the early bird discount if you join by February the 7th.
Here we are. We're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com. Put your name in the sign up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well, and I'll see you again next time.